I'm Barry Ritholtz, and on today's edition of At the Money, we're going to discuss how these changes are likely to affect your portfolios and what you should do about it. To help us unpack all of this and what it means for your money, let's bring in Jim Bianco, Chief Strategist at Bianco Research. His firm has been providing objective and unconventional commentary to professional portfolio managers since 1990s and remains amongst the top-rated firms amongst institutional traders. So let's start with the prior cycle. Rates were very low for a very long time. Tell us why.
Coming out of the financial crisis in 2008, the Fed was worried that the psyche of investors was to stay away from riskier assets like home prices or equities. Remember, the stock market fell almost 50% in 2008. Home prices had their biggest crash, according to the Case-Shiller measure, ever. And so they wanted to try and reinforce that these assets were safe to own. By doing that, one way to do that was they took safe assets like bonds, treasury bonds, and their yield, and tried to make them very unattractive by lowering their interest rates all the way down to zero. And they used a fancy term for it. They called it the portfolio balance channel, which meant that you were like, I have this internal clock in my head. I need to make so much every year. These bond yields will never get me there. So what do I have to do to make my yield? I have to start thinking about taking on a little bit more risk, putting money in corporate bonds, putting money in equities, maybe putting money more back into real estate again. So the idea behind it was to try and push people into riskier assets.
And we saw in the 2000s, it certainly was a contributing factor to the financial crisis. When they took yields as low as they did, they sent bond managers looking for higher and riskier yields. And it obviously raises a question in the 2010s, why were they on emergency footing long after the emergency ended? How much of this is just a function of the Fed tends to be conservative and move slowly? Is this just the nature of a large, ponderous, conservative institution?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think it is. And you're right. I mean, the first example of emergency policy was after 9/11, when they cut rates down to the unfathomable level back then of around 1%.
Right.
And they kept it there all the way to 2004. And the joke was in 2003 and 2004 was an emergency rate when there was no clear emergency. And by keeping that money cheap, they encouraged speculative movements in markets. And the big one that we all are aware of was housing prices took off like crazy because everybody borrowed at low variable rates and produced a big peak on it. But you're right that the Fed is very, very slow in starting to think. And part of the problem, I think, with the Fed is there's a groupthink at the Fed, that there's a consensus view of the world and everybody is to purport to that view and they don't allow heterodox opinions.
I have a vivid recollection following 08-09 of you and I having a conversation. At the time, we were both constructive, hell, I could say bullish, but for very different reasons. I was looking at, hey, markets cut in half tend to do really well over the next decade, down 57%. I'm a buyer. You were the first analyst of everybody on Wall Street who turned around and said zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing is going to leave no alternative and all of this cash is going to flow into the equity markets. I recall exactly where we were, where we had that conversation. When you talk about change, is that the sort of substantial change in government policy that impacts markets? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it's even more basic than that. It impacts psychology. One of the reasons that the Fed wanted to put rates at zero and push all that money into risk markets was the psyche coming out of 2008 was people were afraid. They were afraid that their nest egg, their net worth, their wealth was at risk and that they could work their whole life, save some money, and it just disappears. And so the fear was that they were just going to all pile it into treasury bills and they were never going to move into risk assets. And without that, you know, investment in the economy, we weren't going to get the economy forward. So they cut rates to zero to force that money in. But what did people do in 2010, 2011, and 2012 when they saw, wait a minute, my house price is recovering, My stock portfolio is recovering. My net worth is starting to go back up. They felt better. Oh, good. My nest egg is still there. It's still safe. It's not going to fall apart. They didn't do anything other than they felt better. They felt a comfort level because that was happening. 2020 comes. We have a big downturn in 2020. We have massive fiscal stimulus. We have massive spending, the CARES Act, as you point out. Here's a fun fact for you. In 2008, the government, you know, to use the vernacular, the government did mail checks to people that were on unemployment. The average check that was mailed to somebody in 2008 was like $25. And they made fun of George Bush. Like, what's this going to do for me, right? You know, it's going to get me it's going to get me and my family dinner for one night. But in 2020, the average check that was mailed to people was thousands of dollars. And I think that changed the psyche. So what happened coming out of 2020 is you've seen a more speculative spending type of environment. First, we saw the meme stock mania, right? You know, when we weren't even out of lockdown. You know, when the government was mailing people money, they didn't have that 2008 mentality. Ooh, let's take that money and put it in a treasury bill yielding zero because it will give me back all my principal and that's good enough. No, we bought GameStop and ran it up, you know, 20x in a month or whatever that crazy number was that we did. But then coming out of that, what we've seen is that the savings rate from 2010 to 2020 averaged 6%. What does that mean? That means for every dollar you make, you spend 94 cents of it, you keep 6 cents in the bank. That's 6% savings rate. It's now 4%. Instead of spending 94%, you're spending 96% of your dollar. That means that the consumption patterns in the US economy, GDP, went from 67% of the economy is personal consumption, you and me and everybody else buying things, goods and services, to 69%. That's why the economy continues to be much, much stronger. That's why I think inflation tends to be stickier. What are we doing now? We're buying things coming out of 2020. We want to live our life. We called it doom spending. We called it revenge travel. And I like to say, we didn't revenge travel once. We've been revenge traveling ever since. And so because we're spending more money, we're seeing higher levels of growth. We're seeing higher levels of inflation. Again, like I said, 3 or 4%, not 8-10 Zimbabwe. And the higher levels of growth and higher levels of spending means that the appropriate interest rate in this environment is higher. It's probably in a 4 or 5% range. If nominal growth is running at 5 or 6%, you should have 5 or 6% interest rates.
So you mentioned equities typically return 8% per year over long periods of time. Given munis and money markets and corporate bonds and treasuries, what does this mean that investors should be thinking about their forward return expectations for equities?
Right now, the equity market is considered to be an index. You put your money in some broad-based fund that buys lots of stocks, whether it's the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ 100 or some other thematic idea, and you just own the market. And the problem with that is that the stock market hasn't really... It's more designed as an instrument to basically take a finite set of capital and give it to winners and take it away from losers. And I'm in the camp that if everybody just plows money into, I'll use a broad example, you know, the Russell 1000, and all 1000 stocks get money in proportion that they own the index, whether they're doing a good job or bad job, ultimately that's not a good thing. I would prefer that we got back to something where the original purpose of the market is. And that is that you ferret out good ideas and you put money with them, and you ferret out bad ideas and you take money away from them. That's the nature of capitalism. If there is alternatives, I could stay in bonds at 5%. I could stay in a money market at 5.3%. Now, when I turn to the stock market, maybe I'm not going to look at the stock market more as a, do I own the S&P or don't I own the S&P, a binary decision, in or out, that I look at it a little bit more nuanced. Mm-hmm. And by looking at it more nuanced, do I buy certain themes or other themes? I think you're seeing that on Wall Street.
Active managers have not distinguished themselves in an era of rising indexing. At what point is there enough inefficiency in price discovery that active managers can begin earning their keep?
Oh, I think that we might be seeing it, you know, evolve now with the whole, you know, and I'll answer the question in two ways. In the whole area of like artificial intelligence, and everything else, we're starting to see somewhat of, the fancy Wall Street term is a dispersion of returns,
Right.
that certain stocks are returning much different than other stocks. Look no further than what some of the AI-related stocks are doing. And if you want to look on the other side, the big cap stocks that are really struggling, look at the banks. They're really kind of, retrenching in the other direction because the banks are struggling with overvalued office real estate, and it's
Right.
really starting to hurt them. Where AI is the promise of some kind of, internet 2.0 boom that's coming with technology. And people could start looking at managers to try and differentiate about that. This is not the 2009, 2010 to 2020 period where basically all you needed was, and I'll use the Vanguard example, VOO, which is their S&P 500 fund, 60% in that, and then BND, which is their Bloomberg Aggregate Bond Fund, 40% in that. There, I just need two instruments, 60 in stocks, 40 in bonds. Thank you. Let's see how the decade plays out. I don't think that the next decade is going to be quite like that. As
So,
far as as far as active managers, I did want to make this distinction and throw in a cheap commercial here because I do manage an ETF and explain that. In the equity space, it is well established that active managers have a hard time beating the index. And there's several reasons for it, but I'll give you one basic broad reason. Your biggest weightings, your NVIDIAs, your Microsofts of the world, are your all-stars. And if you're not all in on your all-stars, it is very, very hard to beat the index. And so that's the challenge that an active manager in equities has. In fixed income, the index runs at around the 50th percentile.
right.
There's a lot. Now, one of the big reasons is your biggest weightings in fixed income and bonds are your overlevered companies and your countries that have borrowed too much money. And so they're your problem children. And you could recognize them as your problem children and you avoid them. And that's why so many active managers in fixed income can beat the index. To put a sports metaphor on it, equities is like playing golf. In golf, you play the course, but fixed income is like playing tennis. In tennis, you play the opponent.
Right.
No one asks in, I shouldn't say no one asks, you're more likely in fixed income to be asked the question, not can you beat the Bloomberg Aggregate Index, but can you beat Jeff Gundlach? Can you beat PIMCO? Can you beat Metropolitan West? That's the question you'll be asked in fixed income. In equities, the ask question is, can you beat the S&P 500? Can you beat the course?
So let's put some number, let's put a little flesh on the active bones. You look at the active equity side, and historically, once you take into fees, taxes, costs, after 10 years, active doesn't, there's very, very few winners. But on the fixed income side, it seems like there are many, many more winners in the active bond management. If nothing else, as you mentioned, you screen out the highest risk players, the bad companies, the over-leveraged countries, and just dropping the bottom, pick a number, 20, 30% of the worst participants, you're way ahead of the index. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yes, and that's exactly right because it's a very different type of game in fixed income where it is, just avoiding the landmines is really all you have to do, and you wind up doing better. And remember, by avoiding the landmines, the other thing that's different about fixed income now relative to the last 15 years, there's a yield. As I said,
That's
there's a
right.
yield to observe. So if you can avoid those landmines and continue, you could start the year by saying on a fixed income portfolio, a broad-based bond portfolio, it's going to return 4.8%. That's if every price is unchanged, that's what the yield's going to be. Now, I've got to try and avoid those landmines that keep taking me down from 4.8%. And trying to protect that yield and hold as much of that yield as I can. And maybe along the way, through macro policy or inflation outlook or something like that, I could maybe get into price appreciation to go up to get a little bit more on that. But really what you're doing with fixed income is you're starting at 4.8% and you're just trying not to lose it by of having all those problem children in your portfolio. Equities, I agree with you that after fees, taxes, everything else. I think that traditional CFA portfolio where, you know, there's 11 sectors of the S&P, which four are you going to be overweight, which four are you going to be underweight, which two are you going to be under neutral weight, I don't think that works anymore. I think what you said, an ornament type of thing, is more of a, you're a specific type of manager. I'm going to be, you know, an expertise in consumer. And so, you know, I we're going to ferret out the best consumer stocks or in technology or in financials or in value or in growth. And you're going to be kind of a niche player that's going to take more risk and offer more return, but you're not presenting yourself as a core holding of anybody's portfolio. You're presenting yourself, I like your term, as an ornament is what you're going to do. And that's where I think the active play space should go. You know, the days of Peter Lynch being the core holding and that I will, you know, be everything for you, both the core holding and somebody that can give you some outperformance, that may not be the case. But maybe you could say, look, I think that AI is going to be a big thing. I want to put 10% of my money in AI and I want to pick two managers or three managers that really, I think, understand what's going on in that space and turn them loose on it. That's where I think we're going to be going with this.
So to wrap up, from the dot-com crash to the COVID-19 pandemic, that's 2000 to 2020, monetary policy was the chief driving force in markets. But since the 2020 CARES Act, the pandemic, which led to an infrastructure legislation, to the semiconductor bill, to the Inflation Reduction Act, the shift has been to fiscal, not monetary stimulus. This tends to mean higher GDP, higher inflation, higher yields, and perhaps lower market returns from the equity portion of your portfolio.